Hey, and welcome to the Android Central Podcast. It is Friday, January 24th, 2020. I'm still not used to saying that.
Where did January go?
My name is Daniel Bader, that voice all the way out on the west coast of the United States of America, Andrew Martinick.
There you go. Hello.
Of America. And yeah. Deep in the cockles or the subcockles of the great American Midwest.
Cockles.
Is Jerry Hilton wow. Brand.
What's hey, going on? Howdy from the cockles.
That's going to be one of those episodes, Daniel.
It'll be one of those episodes. I've had a day, so yeah, let's dive right in. So we're going to go right into what a lot of people are talking about this week. It's basically encryption. Every tech podcast that you're going to listen to this week is going to revolve somewhat around this controversy of Apple dropping its plans to encrypt backups after the FBI complaint back in 2018. And that revolves around a couple of specific incidents. The first incident revolved a terrorist attack in San Bernardino, California, where the FBI asked Apple to unlock the alleged terrorist's phone, and they refused. It was an iPhone 6, and at that point, it had been upgraded to an operating system that was using encrypted passcodes. Before that, it was possible to decrypt those keys. And then more recently, with a similar attack on a naval base in Pensacola, Florida, the FBI under Bill Barr is asking the same thing. So this report comes out from Reuters and says that, yes, Apple is really pushing hard for full encryption of its phones on the device, but that's not true of iCloud. And there's a reason for that. Obviously, people go to the Apple store and they're like, I forgot my passcode. How do I get my stuff? And Apple has the ability then to say, okay, well, if you don't remember your passcode, we still have a backup for you that's stored on iCloud. It might not be from today or yesterday, but it'll get most of your stuff back. And that's their reason for not encrypting iCloud backups. But this is a big deal because, Jerry, as you wrote this week, Google does encrypt its backups of people's Android phones, starting with Android 9 Pie. And there was a big push for this. And they, you know, Google hired an independent auditor to make sure that its process was sound. Tell us about that and about why you think Google decided to do it.
Google backup, you've seen it even if you don't think you know what we're talking about. Whenever you set up an Android phone, it's part of the process. Samsung and LG, and probably Motorola, I haven't used one in a while, also offer a very similar service. There's a good chance they're just using Google's service and made it look pretty during the setup. But you opt in to back up your data to, it's called Android Backup. And what that is it's a space in your Google Drive account that's hidden that you can find it if you look for it. But if you just go to Drive on the web or through the app on your phone, you won't find it, where an end-to-end encrypted package of all your data is kept. What end-to-end means is the only way that package can be decrypted is if you supply the credentials to encrypt it, or decrypt it. Google has no way of opening that up. It happens automatically at least once a day. It'll back up any setting or data that a developer chooses to include, and right there is its weak spot. Google doesn't enforce it. All your Google apps are there. Most of your Google app data is in the cloud anyway, but I used Calendar as an example. Your calendar data is all kept in the cloud, but your preferences for your app or your settings or, you know, remind me one day before the event, that kind of stuff, that all gets backed up. But a third-party app, everything in the settings and the data, you know, your game progress, your messages if you don't use Android messaging. All that is able to be backed up automatically if the developer chooses to include it.
I think that the difference, like there's a completely different story happening with what Google's doing and what Apple's doing, just from the standpoint of, like, when Apple does an iCloud backup, it's effectively like a clone of your phone in a big blob at Apple. Whereas, just as you explained, there are lots of different intricacies with the Google version, with some things like, I tend to think of all the things tied to my Google account and being in the cloud as separate from the kind of backup they're doing at a device level. And maybe that's just because I'm so used to switching between a lot of different devices and having a lot of cloud accounts. But right. Google really leans on the cloud part of things on an account basis, whereas Apple is much more cohesive based on a device basis.
Well, yes and no. My favorite game here recently, it's a silly little game called Archero. You run around, you shoot things with a bow. It uses Google Backup. I can pick up any phone, and the progress is right there. I can buy a brand new phone, and during setup, say, you know, restore with data from my Pixel 4, and it'll pick up right where I left off. Then I can go back to my Pixel 4, and as long as it's, you know, been an hour or so since I used it on another phone, my progress is all there.
Right.
It works across all of your devices. What iCloud does is, you know, it syncs your iPhone data. And, you know, even at the free level, it syncs enough data to be very, very useful. This is more like you can plug your iPhone into a PC and make a true one-to-one backup. You can't do that with Android, so this is the closest thing Google can get. You still have to download your apps, but as you're downloading them, the backed up data is getting entered into the right spot in your phone system software, so it looks like it did on your last phone.
So I think that's why it's just important to realize those differences when we're talking about, you know, where your data is stored and how it's encrypted and, you know, who has access to it. Because the question with an iPhone of where is my data is a lot simpler than on an Android phone. You say, where is my data saved and potentially shared? It could depend on the app.
Right.
And the phone.
Google approaches this in a very democratic way. You know, it's stored in a Google Drive folder. But that folder is the contents of that folder is encrypted, and they use the phone's PIN code or password PIN code or pattern code to encrypt
right.
the access to that information. And when it goes to one of their data servers, it uses the Titan security chip to basically hide that key. And the decryption key is then only accessible once you have entered an equivalent of your PIN or passcode. I feel like that is sound. And they've done a bunch of math to figure out that if, I think it's 10 times, if you enter that code incorrectly 10 times, it actually purges your backup data from right. their servers completely, not just in one place, but in all of the places. And, you know, it's funny that Google has never been criticized by the U.S. government for this, at least not publicly, in the same way Apple's been criticized for not giving on-device access to their phones. And I wonder if it's just because there are fewer warrants for these kinds of requests. Like, you know, there aren't, I mean, I'm sure there are, but maybe it's not as public, criminals going around using Android phones to plan terrorist attacks or major drug deals. At least the major ones, the terrorists that have been accused of these crimes, they've all used iPhones so far.
And I think there's something, to be said with, like, it's an easier target. You know who makes every iPhone. and you know with things like iCloud where the entirety of the phone's data could be stored, whereas it's a little more confusing on the Android side with, well, do you go after Google? Do you go after the specific app developer that you need the, you know, the keys to unlock data for a specific app? Do you go to the manufacturer? What version of Android is that phone on? You know, all of those things also factor into, you know, does the FBI or the NSA already have an exploit to get into these phones because it's, you know, a several version old Android phone? And like, they don't have to go badger Samsung about it because like, they can just, if they have access to the phone, they can already get into it. Just as is often the case with older iPhones.
That's exactly what I think the reason why it doesn't hit the news that the FBI wants Google to stop encrypting, you know, backups. Number one, a subpoena will give the FBI that all those binary blobs. They're encrypted, but they're stored in your Google Drive, and you know it's easy for the FBI to get a warrant. And Google,
it's easy for them to get the warrant, but the blobs aren't going to do anything without the right encryption keys. And no FBI. I mean, the whole thing with the San Bernardino problem was that they were asking Google to do it, or Apple to do it, and Apple said no. And then it came out months later that they got a zero-day exploit from the NSO anyway, and that's how they broke into the phone. And I mean, it's not clear what was obtained by getting physical access to the phone that they didn't already have through the backup, but that's not really the point. The FBI just wants...
But what I was saying is 0 days exist for everything, including the lock screen on your phone. I don't care how new your phone is. If there's not an exploit to get past the lock screen today, there could be tomorrow. And once that happens, the FBI knows it's there. Once they get past the lock screen on your Android phone, they have that data decrypted. That's why I think that the FBI is not pushing Google to stop doing it.
Right.
You can use a separate key for your iCloud backups, which, you know, you can get into somebody's iPhone and you still can't have access to the iCloud backup.
And you can, of course, turn off iCloud backup.
Right,
And you can locally encrypt your backups onto your computer.
Yeah, you could turn off iCloud backup and do an encrypted cable backup.
You can also opt out and purge all your backed up data on Android right in the settings under backup. If you turn that off, it's wiped. If you want it to be able to use it again in the future, you need to turn it right back on. But if you want to destroy old data for some reason or another, you can shut that off and then pick up your phone a couple minutes later and turn it back on, and all your old encrypted data is gone.
I was listening to a podcast this morning. It's called Pivot. It's hosted by Kara Swisher and Scott Galloway, and it's an interesting show, and they were talking about this, and they mischaracterized Android to the point where I was really quite upset at just the naivete of the whole thing. A lot of kind of Silicon Valley pundits and analysts and critics, they don't really see a lot of Android phones. I'm guessing they don't see them in their day-to-day, you know, business. I feel like most, if in the US especially, the breakdown between iOS and Android is, you know, it's heavier on the side of iOS. Most people that you know probably have an iPhone. If you have an Android phone, you may be one of a handful of people in your family or friend group. I think most Americans have accepted that. But what he said is that most Android users don't really have an expectation of privacy, that they are more budget-focused, and that this idea of privacy is built into the price tag of the iPhone, that if you pay $1,000 for an iPhone 11 Pro, your expectation of privacy is necessarily higher than somebody who spends $200 on a Moto G7.
I hate that trope so much.
And I think it's true.
It's not. Oh my God, hang on a second. It may be true in the sense that your primary purpose of buying a phone may not be to have the most secure phone on planet Earth, because you have more important things on your mind, because you're, and I really don't want to generalize here, but let's just say that you are not as, you know, well-to-do as the average middle-class American. And when you buy a phone, you're not really thinking about the camera. You're not really thinking about the smoothness of the software. You just want to buy a phone that lets you connect to the internet and communicate with the people in your life. And that is the priority. Then yes, maybe backing up, you know, encrypted backups to Google Drive is not top of your mind. But to say that there is not the same expectation, or maybe the, I mean, are we separating expectation from what people deserve? But even then, everybody deserves to have the same access to encrypted backups and encryption and security and privacy in general. But even if you're not thinking about it, it's something that you shouldn't have to think about, because Google supplies this for free.
Yeah, the issue with that thought process of people with iPhones care more about privacy is that they don't. That nobody on average cares about privacy or factors that into their buying decision. There are a million different reasons why people are buying iPhone 11 Pros on average. That, you know, Apple keeps my data more private is, you know, number 999,500 on that list. They do not care. They're looking at a million other reasons to justify that $1,200 phone.
But what I was talking about is, if you spend $1,000 on a phone, you should expect the company to do everything they can to protect your data. But there are plenty of $1,000 Android phones too.
Exactly. But the thing is, there are plenty of $1,000 Android phones made by companies that also make $100 Android phones.
Right.
And the cool thing, those companies are not spending the time to create the infrastructure to ensure that your privacy is secure on all of those SKUs, regardless of how much cost the BOM, you know, the BOM should be irrelevant to the security of the software. And if you're talking about hardware exploits, that's something different, because usually it requires on-premises interaction with the device.
So once somebody gets your phone, it's game over.
Correct. And that applies to iPhones and Android users alike, $100 to $2,000 phones.
The cool thing is, even if you don't have the expectation that your $200 Nokia Android phone is going to take good care of your backed up data, it is anyway, because Google's doing it for them.
Yeah, and I think that that makes the biggest point of all this is, no matter what phone you get, $200 Android phone, $1,200 Android phone, iPhone 7 that they're still selling, or iPhone 11 Pro, your actions on the phone in many cases are the most important part of whether or not your data is quote-unquote secure or quote-unquote private from whoever you're trying to keep it secure and private to and from. Your actions and the apps that you use and the services you choose to use and the settings you choose to use are way more important than the underlying platform. Like, the underlying platform of your phone and who made it and when it was made and when the last security patch was, when that was, is far more important for somebody who is a target of a specific attack. That's when that starts to matter. The average person is not targeted for a specific attack, and their choices of what services and apps to use are the much more important part of that scenario.
But the thing is, people are phished all the time, right? People are sent errant, and corrupt files all the time. And there are so many layers of protection between that compromised file and your finger tapping on that file, that it's not just the platform owners that are responsible for this. I mean, if let's talk a little bit about the alleged attack on Jeff Bezos, the CEO
somebody
of Amazon,
that's a target
who is a massive target for this kind of attack. And he was allegedly targeted by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, who is allegedly, although I shouldn't have to say allegedly because it's pretty much proven at this point, behind the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. So the coincidence here is pretty interesting in the sense that, yes, it seems like Bezos has a personal relationship with MBS, which is weird in and of itself, but
definitely okay, having different kind of WhatsApp chats than I am.
He's also a man who has the personal wealth of like not Switzerland. Let's say Sweden or Norway.
He's one of the only people that has personal wealth on the same level as the crown prince of Saudi Arabia.
I would be interested to learn if that's true.
A country built on top of oil reserves.
Yeah, I even if it's not, like he's got substantial resources behind him. So he apparently opened a video file that was sent from MBS that was infected with some sort of malware. Presumably, it was a zero-day exploit. It's not clear if the exploit took advantage of WhatsApp or whether it took advantage of iOS. We're pretty sure there was no confirmation in the Guardian report that he was using an iPhone. But even if it was just a WhatsApp exploit, somehow that allowed the hacker to get all of his photos. And that allegedly led to the extraction of compromising photos of him and his mistress, which then led to him going public with that information and his divorce with his then wife, because the National Enquirer got hold of those photos and some text messages. Now, Jerry, it's not easy for a corrupt video file in WhatsApp to grab your text messages and your photos, especially on iOS. So this must have been a pretty sophisticated exploit.
Yeah. Whether it was an iOS exploit or if he was using an Android phone, an Android exploit, or a WhatsApp exploit, or maybe a third-party video player exploit, no matter what it was, that this just goes to show that all software can be exploited, and there are zero-day exploits for every single piece of popular software out there.
So... A lot of people are kind of likening this to, the fact that this went over WhatsApp and the fact that Jeff Bezos, you know, Mr. Money or Money, you know, Monsieur Moneybags or whoever you want to refer to Bezos, he was just a guy talking to another guy over a very, very, like it was a free, granted end-to-end encrypted, but free messaging service owned by Facebook. And a lot of people are saying, well, Facebook should be culpable to some extent for this because it went over their servers. But as we know, with the RCS rollout, and the stunted and barely recognizable RCS rollout, the one thing that WhatsApp has going for it is end-to-end encryption. And you really cannot fault Facebook for not intervening when it comes to a file that it had no idea the contents of sent over its servers.
And that's one of the reasons why they're happy to promote the fact that it has end-to-end encryption, because it takes them out of the equation in terms of culpability.
Yes. If you want to blame Facebook for this, that means you believe Facebook is reading all your WhatsApp messages.
Well, I did get that ad for, whatever.
Visits to Saudi Arabia.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Because I definitely plan on going there.
No, there are analytics from WhatsApp that Facebook harvests, but
Facebook harvests every data point it possibly can. But I mean, let's be honest here, right? Like Facebook, they butt up against what is allowed from a, an ethical and moral perspective when it comes to user interaction. And then there's a bunch of people who discover this, or somebody discovers it, puts it out, and then there's a huge backlash, and then Facebook walks it back a little bit. And then the next time, they go a little bit further than they went before, and eventually they get to the point where we're not recognizing that they're just trampling on our on our rights and our security and our privacy. And over the last 15 years or so, that is basically how Facebook has won. I believe today Facebook is set in an hour or so from the time of recording is set to release its quarterly earnings, and it's expected to reach all-time highs for revenue and profit, despite all of the pushback that it's received over the last few years. So anyway, it is what
it is. Just go, like, the whole discussion just goes back to my previous point of it doesn't matter whether Bezos was using an iPhone or a Samsung or a Google phone or anything like that. He chose to use this specific messaging service, and he obviously didn't know that there was a, that would have opened him up to an exploit from somebody that could harvest the data off the phone. But it ultimately didn't matter. He could have used WhatsApp or whatever, iMessage or just a regular text message or any other messaging app, and there probably would have been a way for them to get that malformed message sent and get that data off of him. The biggest thing was he chose to interact with that person, and he was a target for that to happen. It didn't matter what service he was using, and it didn't matter if his data was encrypted, because when his phone is unlocked, that data is not encrypted. And if there's an exploit and he's actively using the phone and opens the file, it's game over.
Anybody that blames, you know, Apple, we assume he used an iPhone, or Facebook or WhatsApp, or blames Jeff Bezos himself, is pointing the finger in the wrong direction. This was a guy having a WhatsApp conversation with another guy who he apparently trusted and opened up a video file the same as any one of us and any one of you listening would open if somebody you thought your friend sent you a file to open.
If MBS sent me a photo or a video of a really cute dog, I would open it. I would have no choice. I would be compelled to see what cute things that dog would do. And
so you blame the Saudi crown prince. That's the only
I blame him
to blame.
For having really good taste in memes. Okay, so let's go back to this original point, though, about the should Apple encrypt iCloud backups? Like, there are a billion active iPhone users out there, many, many millions of iPad users. All of them deserve privacy, and all of them deserve the same protection as Jeff Bezos or whoever else. But Apple's choosing not to encrypt it for practical reasons. They're saying, if we encrypted your backup using some method, whether it's your PIN code or something else, and you don't know your PIN code, which is why people go into the Apple store in the first place, then you're screwed. You just don't have access to your phone anymore. You're done. You can put it into recovery mode, but you need your password, your iCloud password, to recover that phone, and then you will have lost all the data.
See, now you've got my cockles up.
Well, that's not surprising since you live in the cockles of America.
Your iCloud backups are encrypted.
They are. You're right.
But
let's get the language down.
Right. Apple holds a key to decrypt.
Yeah. They're not trust no one encrypted.
And that's, I don't hate that idea. I wish Google did the same thing. But I wish that both of the services gave you the option. We can, in plain language, we can encrypt your data and also keep the means to decrypt it in case you ever lose your credentials or forget your password. But yes, that means the government can ask us to decrypt the data for you, or you can choose to manage it yourself.
Yeah, this is just the larger scale version of what we've talked about a lot with password managers, where, okay, do you want to pay LastPass every single month to hold on to your blob of data? And if you forget your master password, they can help you with that. Or do you want to flip the switch and encrypt it yourself and upload it to your own service with a different password manager that lets you be the only bearer of the keys? But if you, forget that master password, you're completely screwed and you can't get into it. Most people are going to take the former. And this is why I hate that discussion that Daniel was pointing out from the podcast where they, you know, everybody just, you know, pontificates about how Apple users care about their privacy more. It's like, no, if they did, then they would be pressuring Apple to have that option for the fully encrypted, you know, only you have the keys backup. But the average Apple user doesn't care about that.
Right. It's like here, take my keys and throw them in the ocean because I don't want them anymore.
Yeah, the average person cares way more about being able to call Apple or walk into an Apple store and be like, I forgot my password, and having the person behind the counter be able to help them. That's what they care about.
But what's interesting here is that Google is, you know, when we talk about Apple, we refer to a hardware company first. And as a result, they took a really long time to get the cloud right. And I'd argue that they still haven't gotten the cloud right in the same way that Google has. And as a result, it feels like default behavior from Google, that it was never in question that Google would end up backing things up automatically and then encrypting them on your behalf, because we always had the confidence that it would do that. And if you know Google as a company, right, all the Google naysayers really don't understand the business model, right? They say, oh, Google sells our data. And Jerry has said and written about many, many, many times, that is not true. Google never sells your data, and it uses all of the data that you provide of your own volition to target ads towards you, and that is their business.
Yeah, it's too valuable to sell.
So the reason that Google is so good at that is because it knows what to target, because it has all those data points, because you are voluntarily uploading things all the time to their servers. Apple took years to get things right, to be able to sync messages between devices properly, to be able to have a seamless iCloud backup solution that didn't require you plugging your goddamn iPhone into your computer every time, right? Like,
didn't you hate those days?
It wasn't that long ago that you still had your 30-pin connector plugged into your, you know, Mac, you know, your massive Mac, and hoping that the backup worked.
And so, it still wasn't encrypted unless you chose to make it so.
Right. So let's not forget that, you know, Apple does not have a great track record here. And Google, for all of its faults, does.
The biggest thing I'd like to see Google change, even more than forcing developers to use backup, is right now when you set up a Google account, you can go through a process where a different person can get involved in recovering your account if you forget the password. Most people aren't going to do that. And if you haven't done that and you forget your password when you're trying to set up a new phone, or you get locked out of your current phone because you forgot the lock screen password and try to reset it and don't have your Google password, all of your backup data is gone forever. And I've went through this with my mother. I helped my mom set up her Google account originally. And if there's ever a problem with her password, I get involved and I can talk to Google and they'll let me reset her password for her, which is pretty cool. And it worked, and it got her back in her phone, and everything was just like it should be. But if she hadn't have done that, everything she ever had was gone. I would like to see Google either make that a mandatory thing, even if that means you have to go get a Hotmail account and just provide a secondary, you know, email a secondary person to help you on your behalf, or give users the option for them to hold a key. Just because most users care more about having the data backed up and aren't worried that the FBI is going to rifle through it. They just want to have a nice backup in case they ever need it.
Yeah, that's the bigger, in so many people's eyes, the bigger frustration with Google is not having that one, you know, big backup like iCloud, or not knowing how to be able to recover things. Like, that's the bigger frustration to the average user than, you know, somebody's going to send me a malformed video and, you know, dump my entire phone to someone, you know, to blackmail me.
So what's interesting is that Google has tried to address this with Google One, but it's arguably done a pretty piss poor job doing it. Google One is the kind of all encompassing. It's a relatively new product. It's from 2018. It includes your Google Drive, Google Photos, storage.
So many people are like, what the hell is Google One?
Right. It kind of dovetailed from the premium tiers of Google Drive backup sizes, right? So if you wanted 200 gigs, you would pay $3 a month. 2 gigabytes, you'd pay $10 a month, et cetera, et cetera. But Google has also combined discounts to the Google Store. It's combined tier one service in Google One. And I think most importantly, it is now using Google One as a centralized place for your phone backups. So even if you're running a Samsung phone.
Yeah, I see that on the dashboard now.
Yeah, I mean, even if you're running a non-Pixel phone, you can ask Google to back up your photos and your MMS messages because your OEM is backing up your regular text messages. That's what's so confusing about this, is that it's piecemeal. It's not really a full spectrum solution.
And the toggle for device data, it doesn't say what's in that. And you could just turn it off and delete it all, which to Jerry's point is great. You could turn it off and delete it if you want it. But it doesn't actually say what's being backed up, because obviously it's going to differ on every phone and every set of apps you have. But it's very interesting that you can just see it there and turn it right off and delete it.
Do you want to be even more frustrated?
Of course.
If you go to the Android developer site and dig through the documentation for Android backup, it does tell you what gets backed up. But nowhere for their users to read at all.
Yeah, not at all. It just says device data. Like, how would a normal person ever know that?
And it's too ambiguous. And it's also, you know, going back to the original thing Jerry said, you don't know which apps are participating in this process, and you can't force your favorite game to back up to Google Play Games or whatever. And like every time that I reinstall Hold Down, which is like my waiting 5 minutes in line default game, it doesn't restore my progress. And it's like the one game that I play on my phone. So every time I install it on a new phone, I have to start from zero. And it's so frustrating.
Yep.
Because I feel like it's just I feel like in the back end, it's just like a toggle. Like, check this box to back up to Google.
Almost. It's almost that easy.
They just don't do it. And
if it was even just as clear as knowing for sure it wasn't being backed up, I think it's the ambiguity is the problem. You can't, for yourself or for anybody else you're trying to help, say for certain one way or the other unless you have personally done it before. And even still, in Jerry's example with his game that does back up properly, you know, when is it backing up? How do you know? Do you know for certain how, you know, do I need to wait 2 hours after I played it on one device to go over to the other device? It's not very clear.
Right. And then on the other side of the spectrum is Google Photos, which if you literally take a photo and you're on Wi-Fi and you go to the web page, the web portal, it'll be there. And it works. It's reliable. It's a great experience. So we know Google can do it. But unfortunately, it's just not in the business of forcing its partners to do things that would objectively be good for its users.
And you see little flourishes of it working, you know, when we switch phones so often, that sometimes when you're moving from one Pixel to another and it like restores your whole home screen and all the apps install and some of the data comes over, you're like, I can see this working, and it would be amazing if it just worked as you expected it to, but it kind of like half works.
Let's put that one to bed, because I'm sure there will be a lot more to talk about. Although Apple has, let's just complete that thought. Apple was accused of going back on its decision to encrypt its iCloud backups. Apparently somebody, an Apple source, told the FBI this. Then the FBI went, no, please don't do that. We need you, buddy. And Apple said, fine, I'll do this for you, but you owe me. And then they went out and got ice cream. But Apple responded by saying, we would never disclose future product information, especially to the FBI. So why would they know this? But apparently it was some source that did not want that, that Apple should not have let leak this information. Anyway. All right. Sonos is under, Sonos is people are mad. Let's put it that way.
I put this on the run sheet just for you.
This has been such a freaking hard, it's hard to parse, Andrew, because I love my Sonos products so much. And yet I totally understand why people are mad. So let's go through the whole story. Basically, Sonos did not used to be a cloud service, a cloud speaker company. They used to make,
it was all about local network.
Yeah, they used to make a bunch of networked gear that worked together so you could hook up your existing speakers to a mesh network within your house and get all of your speakers playing the same locally stored files without any lag, so they would be perfectly in sync, and your house would be full of, you know, John Coltrane or Rush or the Beatles or whatever. R.I.P. Neil Peart. So now, this was like 15 years ago when the company started. It was a private company. It was really small. It was niche. And since then, Sonos has gotten big, and I mean relatively big, right? They have expanded. They've gone public. They've released a bunch of really successful, really design-forward mesh networked speakers, essentially. And they've built this really strong back end to allow all these speakers to talk to one another without lag and without a central hub. They used to require this network bridge that would connect to your router that would keep all these speakers in sync. But instead, they've basically built this separate mesh network that lives above or below or, you know, within or whatever analogy you want to use, your main 2.4 and 5 gigahertz router network. Okay, so Sonos announced that a bunch of its old products were no longer going to be updated because they're old. They're like between like not 6 and 15 years old. And as a result, they won't receive updates because they just can't support this old hardware anymore. So people were like, okay, that sucks, but we understand. But then they were like, but if you keep these products connected to the rest of your newer Sonos stuff, your newer stuff won't receive any updates either. And then people got real mad because when you say that, you potentially lose out on updates to music services, to, you know, improvements to the UI, to all the good stuff that people expect.
You basically get stuck in time at the point that the, like, the lowest common denominator stops getting updated.
Exactly. So this happens, but this is parallel to another controversy that Sonos is dealing with, where if you decide that you want to take advantage of this, of an upgrade system that Sonos has put in place for these older products, you get 30% off newer Sonos gear, but those older Sonos products go into what is essentially a recycling mode, where after 31 days, they are no longer going to work. They are bricked, essentially. And Sonos is doing this because they want to encourage people to physically recycle those products without having to deal with privacy information leaking out or any liability on their part. A lot of people were like, okay, that's dumb. Why would you just kill a device? But Sonos is one of those companies that really believes in like the end user experience. They're like, we want all of our products to work really well all of the time. And because these are 15-year-old products, we cannot guarantee that something we built in 2005 is going to perform at the level that we expect other Sonos products to work with. So we're just going to kill it. But hey, here's 30% off our new $500, you know, amp or whatever. So people got real mad at all this stuff. And this is happening at the same time that Sonos is suing Google for patent infringement. And that is just insane. So I'm going to read a statement that Sonos has issued from CEO Patrick Spence. We are not bricking them. We are not forcing your products into obsolescence, and we are not taking anything away. Many of you have invested heavily in your Sonos system, and we intend to honor that investment for as long as possible. While legacy Sonos products won't get new software updates, we pledge to keep them updated with bug fixes and security patches for as long as possible. He goes on to say, secondly, we heard you on the issue of legacy products and modern products not being able to coexist in your home, and we are working on a way to split your system so that modern products work together and get the latest features while legacy products work together and remain in their current state. We are finalizing details on this plan and we'll share more in the coming weeks. So, Jerry, you are a hi-fi guy. You are an analog guy. You buy wired headphones. You buy headphone amplifiers. You have expensive tower speakers that hook into AV receivers. You are not a Sonos person.
Right. So I am not a Sonos fan. But
what do you take from all this? Because holy cow, this is insane.
My first take is the final outcome means that the next product Sonos releases is going to cost more because they have to spend more time figuring out a way to make it work with new stuff that they can update without messing with the old stuff. And it's all your fault, people. I say that in jest. People don't understand how stuff like this works. Sonos saying, look, we can't update new gear if you leave it connected to old gear because the old gear just doesn't work with our new ideas. That's no surprise. That didn't surprise me at all. That makes sense. I thought that was great. They're going to let you continue to use the very first Sonos speaker you bought with all this other cool stuff. It's going to do the same thing tomorrow that it did today, and you're not really missing out on anything that you paid for. You may miss out on new features, but that's because you want to hold on to an old device that can't do those new features. As far as the bricking thing, that people got outraged because they weren't smart enough to erase their information from it, sell it on Craigslist first, and then buy the new Sonos gear with 30% off. That way they don't have brick devices that they need to take to the recycle center. All of this is the consumer's quote-unquote fault, but it's because we don't understand how all this stuff works. I think Sonos did a good job responding to it, knowing that it's going to cost them a lot of money and a lot of time to figure out how to do what they promised to do. But what people need to understand is Sonos isn't going to eat all of that cost. It's going to be passed on to the consumer at least a little bit.
Yeah, I think that their response was good. Their initial rollout and messaging was not.
Right. They could have explained that a little bit better because maybe software and hardware nerds at Sonos didn't realize that not everybody understands how this works.
But what? So I want to clarify here, because when you buy basically anything today, when you buy a smart speaker from Google or Amazon or Sonos, when you buy a smart door lock, when you buy an Amazon, I don't want to say the word, let's just say Lexi powered microwave or clock, when you buy literally anything that is considered a smart home gadget, you are basically buying a computer, a small maybe not a computer, a phone, a thing that has phone hardware in it. And over the years, that has become more specialized as companies build more specialized hardware. But at the core, you're basically just buying an internet-connected phone, often without a screen. So with that said, people do not expect their phones to last forever. I mean, Android users, God help us, we know all about that struggle, about not you know, most of our phones don't stay updated for more than 2 or 3 years, if that, especially if you're buying a cheaper phone. And that is not the expectation when you buy a speaker, right? Or a receiver or something that you put in your living room that displays music. People keep that plays music, or people keep their TVs for 15 years sometimes, their fridges for 30 years. Increasingly, your Samsung fridge is going to have software in it that people may expect to stay updated for many, many decades. And that is just not the case. So where is this disconnect between our phones and our computers and the rest of the smart stuff that we're putting in our homes?
I think that, man, I really wish I could credit this thought to the person I heard it from on a podcast, but I listen to too many damn podcasts and I can't keep them straight. But the disconnect there comes from we're used to upgrading our phones on a cadence, which of course is getting longer. We know that upgrades are pushing beyond 2 years now on average, rather than, you know, they were rather short for a while there. But we're upgrading our phones because we carry them, and our laptops and headphones, things like that, because we carry them with us and we use them a lot, and they physically degrade over time. No matter how careful you are or what, you know, case you put on it, your phone is, you know, actually falling apart physically over time. Something like a Sonos speaker, or to a little bit of a lesser extent, a refrigerator or a TV, its useful life as a piece of hardware is vastly longer and able to live on a lot longer than we typically expect from a software update perspective. So when we look at phones and laptops and headphones and things like that, those things, you know, they're wearing out physically at a similar rate to the company's obligation to update the software, you know, whatever they're, you know, they're wearing out on their end in terms of software updates. And there's a disconnect with something like a speaker that sits on a shelf and also is not used but a couple hours a day at most.
Right.
And I think it's also, people don't understand that, you know, maybe once a month, three times a year, whatever interval, that speaker's updating without you knowing it, because there's no user involvement necessary. So people don't realize that smart speakers need software updates.
Okay, so the issue with that is, like, Google and Amazon set this expectation years ago, right? Amazon put out its first Echo speaker 6 years ago. And since then, it has just given people this expectation that Monday morning they're going to wake up, their speaker can do twice as many things as it could yesterday, because it got a server side update. Jerry, you and I have a Lenovo smart display that has an update cadence of, you know, once every 2 or 3 months. But every 2 or 3 months we wake up and it can do a whole bunch of really cool new stuff, and eventually that update cycle is just going to stop, right? The hardware inside it is not going to, the drivers aren't going to be supported anymore. And eventually Lenovo will have moved on to enough new generations that the original is just going to be, like, not worth it. But it's hard to say when people should expect that to happen. And there's a disconnect between the upgrade cycle of our phones and the upgrade cycle of these smart home things, as Andrew said, but there's, I don't think people really think about those smart home gadgets as phones, and they probably should.
They should do like Microsoft used to do and charge you every time there's an update.
Or find other ways to make money from you so that they can justify updating them.
Yeah, no, don't do what Microsoft does now. Go back. I'll pay $100 to update my smart display before I let them do what is happening now with my PC.
I think that Sonos's issue right now is that it's just a casualty of having a product lineup that bridged between two generations of IoT. You know, one generation where we didn't even call it IoT yet, you know, and they were like on the bleeding edge of this sort of stuff. before anybody was thinking about this stuff. The fact that we're still discussing it right now and talking about what's an appropriate amount of time to support something or how you handle end of life on these things should go toward understanding what Sonos has to deal with products that are 10 to 15 years old, which is just it's an eternity in Internet of Things, smart home technology. Things have changed so dramatically that there should be very little expectation that Sonos could have had this roadmap set up from the start or any reasonable amount of time in the past. I think that their issue is that they're playing in this very premium space and people are very invested emotionally and monetarily in their speakers that are high quality, durable goods. And that's what changes the discussion is. It's not just the annoyance or confusion of having to switch to a different smart light bulb. It's I spent over the last decade, I've spent $5,000 on Sonos speakers. Like that's a lot, you know, that discussion is a lot different than some of the things we're talking about today with these cheap IoT devices.
But I mean, even if you buy a $20 Hue light bulb or a $10 no-name connected light bulb, you still don't think that that is going to be the entryway to a household IoT vulnerability, right? Like you people don't really understand that these attack vectors are possible because not only are the products vulnerable, but some of the standards aren't that secure and the communication methods. I mean, we just saw Apple, Google, and Amazon get in bed with one another after many, many years to standardize an IoT to move forward on a new IoT standard that is not Z-Wave or Zigbee or Bluetooth or Thread or whatever, you know, Wi-Fi or any number of the current half-baked solutions that exist in the home. And what's frustrating about it is that all of these companies have been putting out products for years, like nearly a decade since the first smart home products were introduced, and we still don't have uniformity. And when a company like Sonos comes out and says, hey, we've been supporting products for 15 years and you didn't realize it because they just continue to work like day one, and then everybody gets real pissed off, I find it to be extremely unfair.
Yeah, I think people are, that's what I was saying, there's that disconnect, I think, just purely based on the length that people have Sonos gear and how expensive it was, that they're going really hard at Sonos in an arena where they, you know, everybody's treading, you know, an unknown ground.
Yeah, they were one of the first, and I guess that's true. That's the problem with being a first mover in an industry where you kind of shaped the direction, but ultimately other companies are taking the bulk of the profits. And Sonos, for all of its, you know, bluster, is still a relatively small company. It only has a market cap of just over $1.5 billion, right? Compare this to Amazon or Google, which, you know, they've both been trillion-dollar companies, as has Apple. And you think, you know, those companies have not solved the smart home dilemma yet. How can Sonos? And it's doing a pretty damn good job supporting the existing products that its customers have had for over a decade. So I don't know. I'm on Sonos' side here. I get why people are mad, but I'm also a very, very happy Sonos user and advocate. And I still think that they make the best products at what they do by far. Like, no other company does anywhere near as much work making a seamless multi-home, multi-room speaker system. Like, it's not even fair how far away. Even Google and Amazon don't come close. So, yeah, I find the whole thing real frustrating.
Anyway. You should testify in the trial because that means Google would win.
That was another thing that was really interesting. There was a congressional hearing last week where the Sonos CEO, Patrick Spence, testified about why they sued Google and why they decided to go public about this, because they really felt they had no choice, because Google has so much market power and they want Google to be regulated. They want all the big tech firms to be regulated. And they were up there with the CEO of Tile, the CEO of Tile, the CEO of PopGrips, and the co-founder of Ruby on Rails. And you know, all of them went through, like, one of them had a problem with Apple, one of them had a problem with Amazon, a couple of them had a problem with Google, but all it came down to...
a very odd situation.
Yeah, it was so different, but ultimately, it was all about them not feeling like the market was fair, and it wasn't fairly competitive in a way that it used to be. So I find that fascinating. Anyway, let's finish up, because we just saw this really interesting leak from XDA, and it's all about this smart sharing, quick sharing thing that Google has been building for years. It's called Nearby Sharing. I think that's its final name. It's going to be baked into Android, presumably Android 11, and it's just going to be easy to share large files with nearby phones. So if you go to the Android Central, you can see we have a video of the hands-on, and it's really fast. What do you guys think? Is this a product or a feature that people are actually interested in?
Well, we were talking about this before we started recording, that we love AirDrop. I think it's one of Apple's like most underrated features, or just kind of used but not talked about, just because it really does just work. We use it between MacBooks all the time to share files without a cloud service or a cable, and it's really, really great. And subsequently, Google has been just complete shit at this for so long. Android Beam has been horrible for a long time, and all of these other over-the-top services like Samsung's whatever and Huawei Share, you know, AirDrop, complete copy, like, they're not interoperable in the same way. It's all been based on NFC, which is really funky, NFC and Bluetooth, which is just really bad for big files. So the fact that they're finally getting to this in 2020 is pretty fantastic. I want to see, you know, Google handling it rather than a specific manufacturer. So I'm excited about this.
Too bad. Oppo, Vivo, Xiaomi, Samsung, everybody else, they're not going to use it. They're going to use their own. This is dead in the water.
Yep, Sam Share, Huawei Share.
Google could force them to incorporate it into
Play
services.
And then the EU would sue them for another $70 billion.
No, don't be crazy. That this is
Google can't force an OEM to do anything because of the
way the
license
can. It is. They are forcing OEMs to incorporate specific gestures. If you decide that you want to sign on to Google Play services, they can absolutely force you to use this. And this is not Google Search. This is not Chrome. This is a small feature that a few people would use, and there are no viable market competitors within the Android space. So,
well, I think that the way they can get away with it, like, look, they already require you to pre-install Google Drive. You know, this is way, way less, you know, market lock-in than Google Drive is, because it's local.
But this kills competition. If Google forces
what competition,
you to use-
Jerry?
If Google
for
forces,
USB to C cables,
if Google forces Samsung to install Nearby Sharing, which is a stupid name, the comment on our article that says it just should be called Nearshare, he nails it. He should go to work at Google. But if Google forces Samsung to install it, that kills competition for Samsung's Quick Share.
It doesn't. It gives people double the choice on the same device, which Samsung has been doing for 10 years. And
it'll be annoying because Samsung will definitely still have its own solution.
I mean, think about it, Jerry. They're not, like, in the US especially. I mean, this is, if you're talking specifically about the EU, fine. But Google has been forced to offer the choice of browser when people install or sign onto their phone for the first time, or the choice of search provider. So DuckDuckGo and Bing and I guess the others, as well as like Brave and Opera and Mozilla, you know, those are choices, but they're not telling Google not to include this feature as an option. But even then, they haven't forced Google not to include Drive. They haven't forced Google to not include any of the other parts of Google Play services, including the ones that are duplicative. So I agree that this is just another thing that Google is going to, you know, throw down our, you know, stuff down our throats. But at the same time, I don't think there are any other competitors. I mean, right now, Samsung is still developing its AirDrop clone. Oppo and Vivo are still developing their Samsung AirDrop clone. So, like, how could we say that it would be suppressing competition if there is no competition yet? I like this because it's the one thing that we can say Google has control over. It has control over the experience of Google Play services.
And well, and this is the kind of situation where you want it baked into the operating system. Like, as soon as it requires you to download a separate app, it defeats the purpose.
On a personal level, I want to see Google take complete control and tell everybody, including Samsung, my way or the highway. Because having what we have now with duplicate calendars and all this other nonsense, that's ridiculous. That's just absolutely stupid. But I don't make the rules, and I realize not everybody thinks like I do, and people are going to want Samsung to continue to work on, what are they calling it, quick share, Bixby share, whatever they're naming it. They want Samsung to continue to work.
I guarantee you nobody wants anybody. Nobody wants Samsung to continue
I'll
working
bet
on
there's
Bixby
one
share.
Guy out there. And this might cause Samsung to stop. That's what I'm saying is the bad thing about this that, you know, some governing body like the EU may be interested in looking into. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, this is how it should be done. They should just tell Oppo and Xiaomi and Samsung, no, you're not putting that crap on an Android phone, whether you like it or not. But I also know that that's not ever going to happen.
I mean, I'll just close the point by saying this. Nothing Google does or has done has ever stopped Samsung from trying to build something on top of it.
Samsung always does what Samsung wants.
Exactly. And for better or for worse, it's led to duplicated experiences on Samsung phones for the last decade. And I don't think that's going to stop anytime soon. So, you know, God bless Samsung for having the tenacity to keep on making gallery apps and you know,
the worst,
all the things that nobody wants, its own keyboard, because apparently it still thinks that its keyboard is worth installing over Gboard.
I'd love to see them stand up to Google, but I hate what they do.
Okay, this is a whole other episode, but they do stand up to Google, and then Google comes back and says, "We own your platform. You're welcome to create your own platform. See you later."
Yeah, and I actually see this, what is it, Nearby Share? Is that, man, it is a terrible name. They really just need a brand. I mean, Nearby Sharing, wow. Like this, I see this at a platform level. This is just another, you know, having built-in Nearby Sharing is something on the same level as having, you know, universal permissions management for location access and apps. Like, that's just something that should be happening at the OS level, just like AirDrop. And that's why I don't see it as an anti-competitive situation, because you can still, you know, Samsung can still preload its own, you know, Samsung sharing garbage, and you can still have an app in the App Store, you know, like Droid Zap or whatever, that lets you, you know, share things by NFC. Like, all of those APIs are still available to do Bluetooth Low Energy or Wi-Fi Direct or whatever. But that shouldn't keep Google from making Android really good at it.
But you mentioned Bluetooth. This is just an evolution of Android Beam, where you used NFC to initiate a transfer, and then you used Bluetooth. Or if you're on the same Wi-Fi network, you could use Wi-Fi. and it would share. This just uses Bluetooth to initiate the connection, and then uses Wi-Fi. I don't see anything about it being able to use 4G, but hopefully it can also use a high speed, you know, air connection that's not Wi-Fi after the transfer is set up using Bluetooth,
much like AirDrop does. Right.
So this is an evolution of Android Beam. It's not like Google just decided to do this last week.
Totally. They've just taken forever to do it because, you know, they've been getting trounced by AirDrop in terms of functionality for a very, very long time. And I can't tell you how many times Android Beam has just wholly failed to try to send one image.
Right, because it's trying to send it over Bluetooth, and that sucks.
Yeah, it takes me, every time I tried it, it took me back to using, two Palm, you know, tungsten PDAs and trying to, you know, send a file back and forth.
I'm sorry, like, that's how it still felt. What did you just say? Two Palm tungsten PDAs?
Don't make me get Derek in here.
Well, now that's, you know, you get to relive that with Android Beam, but that was, you know, 15 years ago.
Jesus. We've come so far, and yet we've come almost nowhere.
Yep.
All right. Well, we're gonna end the show there. Thank you, everybody, for listening. It's been a really fun week just following all the news, and I hope you guys have been entertained following the news on Android Central. Because just a quick plug: we've got a big team of news writers now. We've built up that team quite significantly over the last year. And I'm really happy with it. So let us know what you guys think of how we write news, what you'd like to hear differently, what you'd like to see different on the site, or just send some shout outs to the people who work so hard. Podcast at Android Central. We love hearing from you. Andrew, you're at Andrew Martinick. Jerry, you're at GB Hill. I'm at Journey Dan. We're all at Android Central. We will be back next week with another show. Thank you. And so long.
Bye, everybody.
Adios.